throughout our lives, completely outside of our conscious awareness, if you looked at brain scans, what you would see were these immense, very impressive lightning storms, all this electrical activity occurring in vastly different regions of our brain. It would look chaotic, and you'd see all of these different firings and then darkness and then firings that were cascading across a kind of a night sky. But you wouldn't be able to discern a pattern. And even the most skilled clinician who was reading an fMRI or a MEG or a PET scan wouldn't be able to tell from these electrical storms what exact affect, emotional state we were in, what we were thinking, whether we were depressed or happy. It's extremely complex. What we can see is, I'm just going to give you at first, a very, very reductionist, broad overview of what's happening in your brain at any given moment. You've got these pulsating signals from your central processing region, your thalamus, that are being sent by axonic fibers all the way to different sensory processing regions to help you process, the data from light that is left impressions on your retinal nerve, sounds, body sensations. You've got an amygdala, which is constantly scanning for threats, always beneath the level of awareness. And it's sending in 1/10 of a second signals, letting the rest of your body know whether it feels you're safe or endangered, whether it feels there's an opportunity or there's nothing much going around you. It organizes within 1/10 of a second, sends out the neural cluster, the neural signals that will initiate fight, freeze, or fawn reactions. Then you got the striatum, which in response signals out all of the habitual behaviors that we fall into, things like walking, how we digest, how we, the routines of our day, how we move through space. Then you've got a central nervous system that's sending all of these afferent signals down C nerve fibers to your muscles and to your glands, releasing hormones, and then efferent nerve signals come back and tell you how your body's doing. All that's being processed by your somatosensory lobe. And you've got a hippocampus, which is scanning through all the present events and bringing up memories from the past that are similar to this present experience. On top of that, we've got a hypothalamus that's reading all of these states and guiding our endocrine system to release different hormones that create emotional states that prime us to either relax or become excited, to become settled, to sleep, to develop hunger, and so forth. And then we've got other signal, other clusters like this, the cingulate, that are behind the scenes deciding whether to focus on long-term goals or whether to be distracted by sensations in our present experience that have to do with threats or opportunities. I hope that sounds complex, because it is. And the interesting thing is this simplified sketch of the tangled jungle of neural networks all fighting for our attention. Our thoughts are simply a series of narrative words that are constructed by one tiny left frontal lobe region of the brain that have no clue why we've acted, why we feel the things we do. They're simply guesses. But much of our life and our suffering and our frustrations with ourselves and our frustrations with others boils down to this rather tiny fraction of the frontal lobe getting frustrated that it doesn't get to control the whole shebang. and that its goals and plans are being interrupted by these other regions of the brain that are signaling concerns that are every bit as valid as are, you know, the goals that are sustained by top-down circuits in the frontal lobe. We're largely unaware of how all of our emotional, our anxieties, our depression, our stresses, are the times we procrastinate, stall, the times we freeze, all of them, all of these states are expressing very valid concerns about our survival, about connection, about attachment, about searches for pleasure. And it's interesting that we can, for better or worse, maintain the story of exasperation or frustration that not all of these complex circuitries are all getting in line and making it easy for us to go after the goals that a very small portion of the brain focuses on. And I'll talk about that in a moment. The Buddha was the first psychologist thinker to propose a model of mental function that hinted at the complex array of components that are involved and with competing agendas. He, in his model of the mind, he noted that we have things called asayas and asavas, which are unconscious impulses competing with our spiritual goals that express needs for pleasure, security, express fear, express social concerns. And while he noted that if we allow these features to take control, then we don't get to destinations that are goals or establish a sense of achievement in our life. But if we completely suppress awareness of these, he also acknowledged that they still keep popping up and up again and again. And if we don't understand the needs they're conveying, they'll simply continue to interfere with our movement through life. He spoke about things like gut feelings, unconscious beliefs called sanas. He talked about craving states, which are bottom up, stemming from really lower regions of the brain that seem to override us with our addictions and make it difficult for us to achieve our goals. And he noted that at the very top of this pyramid was what he called the mana, which is the verbal thoughts and conscious agendas, which he noted we give far too much attention to. And he also noted that we develop a sense of self by identifying with all the thoughts and narratives and autobiographical stories of this one component of the brain. So let's reel back for a moment. When we're born, we have the most brain cells we'll ever have in our life. It's all downhill from there. You have about 85 billion brain cells. And over the course of the first 2 years, those cells or neurons started sending out these branches of fibers that connected with other neurons. And those are known, all those trees are called, by the way, dendrites, and they connect with axons. And each neuron could have literally thousands of dendrites connecting with thousands of neurons. So when you paint that picture, you multiply 85 billion times 1,000. It is, I can tell you, a large number. I have no clue what it is. But over the course of 2 years, this process, then there's another process called pruning, where we lose 50% of the brain cells and neurons that we're born with. They are all wiped out. So what wipes them out And what connects the durable connections in one region of the brain that will guide how we act throughout our adult life in many ways? Babies learn to survive by sending out emotional signals via body states, cries, nonverbal cues to their caregivers. And their caregivers try to read these needs that are being expressed by meeting the needs and by mirroring the emotions by smiling or telling the child what the child is feeling. And when it all goes well, or even if it doesn't go well, all of those experiences create the very enduring maps of the world sustained by a region in our right frontal lobe, which we now call today attachment styles. And all of that is based on the pruning of neurons and connections due to the early bonds interactions we had with caregivers. And these early models convey beliefs about who we should attach to for love and attention. Sometimes they're good models. If we had attentive caregivers that were reliably available and soothing, then that's who we'll look for in our adult life. If you had a bit of abandoning experience or unreliable attention, then these circuits will develop maps for attachment that are based on looking for people that are not reliable. You'll find people who are emotionally unavailable exciting. And if you were frightened of your caregivers, these neural circuits develop beliefs and hold patterns that look for scary partners in life. So eventually the right brain provides us with balance, full body awareness. It expresses so many of all those unconscious circuits as feelings, gut feelings, and emotions that if we learn to listen to them, can tell us a story about very important concerns. Our emotions and our gut feelings tell us, you know, loneliness is a message that we haven't secured enough tribal affiliations that are presently robust. If we feel anxiety, it means that there's a concern that some of our social bonds are fraying or could be dissolved. If we experience depression, it's because literally there's not enough dopaminergic excitement and involvement in the world. There's an expectation of disappointment. There's all these different concerns about security, bonding, personal safety, all combined and expressing themselves through those embodied states we now just dismiss sometimes as, you know, feelings or emotions, especially negative emotions. It has no plans for the future whatsoever. It doesn't listen to words that other people say. Behind the scenes in every conversation you've ever had, your right hemisphere is looking at people's facial cues to determine whether you feel safe with them, whether you feel they're interested in you, whether you feel that you're important or not. It doesn't see or think of yourself as this whole autobiography that you can recite. It has no idea of how well you did in school or what your job title is. It simply knows, it has gut feelings that reflect, do you feel connected or vulnerable? Are you safe? It's a realm that's extremely metaphoric, Without it, we have no metaphor, we have no poetry, we have no ability to play, no ability to appreciate music, we have no ability to look at art from a Gestalt experience. Bottom-up right hemispheric circuits give us a fulfilling life that accurately expresses some of the most important concerns that we should consider, but they never express themselves as thoughts that you can understand. They're always primarily literally signaling their needs by your gut feelings, your affect states, your emotions, whether you're relaxed or you're jumpy, and so on and so forth. So I guess I'm saying ignore them at your peril. Now, the nonverbal expressions that convey all these needs are sometimes, even in therapists, can undervalue them, referring them as an inner child or as ego dystonic because they interfere with our long-term plans. They can be very frustrating because and people are diagnosed all the time with ADHD because they have jumpy attention that top-down left hemispheric attention can't focus on long-term plans. But all the time, these states are conveying information. Now, starting around age 3 or 4, the left hemisphere begins to develop and starts representing life in language, in words, in ideas. It doesn't establish dominance or the dominance of our conscious awareness until around age 7. But around that time, our thoughts become a kind of ivory tower that represent all of our lived experience in ideas and in stories. Our sense of self is no longer the embodied feeling of our right hemisphere that swarms the child via emotions. It now becomes who we are becomes a story of all the achievements, all the things we've done, all the setbacks, and so forth. It separates the world into objects to be manipulated, and it inhibits all the messages from the bottom up so that we can sustain attention on long-term goals. So when you have a plan, when you have a map of the world that you sustain, when you are disregarding all the signals from your body and focusing attention on learning something or doing a task that is very sequential, then you are pretty much in what's called right top-down processing. This region is concerned deeply with what other people think about us. Not how secure we are, not how well attached we are. That's your right brain, right bottom up concern. Your left thinking realm is concerned about simply what are the thoughts other people have about me. It's concerned about tribal status. It's concerned about accumulating resources that will make us look good to others. When we think about bling or gadgets or brands, that's the region that's responsible. It's very optimistic and it's incessantly future oriented and views the past as completely inconsequential, and all of the emotions stemming from past experiences like grief, sadness, loneliness, disappointment are considered by this region of the brain to be intrusions that are inconvenient. When we have anxiety, grief, loneliness, these withdrawal emotions are largely bottom up right. But when we have anger, it's top down left. Why? Well, because anger requires an ongoing narrative of recitation internally of resentments. So it's anger actually tends to be the most language oriented of all the affect states. People who have avoidant attachment, when they visualize or think about their partners under brain scans, they are very left dominant. They don't integrate emotions or needs for attachment into their their dominant processing. They view other people's minds as inscrutable, and they find other people's emotions to be overwhelming. They need control, and they find it very frustrating when other people express emotions that don't make logical sense to them. So the key is not to disregard all of these regions, the left top down, which holds long-term models and plans, all of our stories that we can share with each other, the way we can, the goals for the future that can tell a story of who we are and where we come from, as well as the bottom-up emotions and feelings that have very little language activity, sometimes some metaphoric, simple language, but is mostly conveys its needs through feelings and body states. The key is to integrate these needs together so that we actually begin to make choices and plans that consider all of our needs. There's classic situations in life where people become dominated by one set of neural firing patterns at the expense of the other, and they make really poor choices. I'll give you like an example. Somebody who constantly fears rejection, stalls and procrastinates before ever applying for a new job, never puts themselves forward, always withholds stating their needs or their desires, can be certainly said, as Dan Siegel and Alan Shore have noted, famous neuropsychologists have noted, are in those moments guided by right bottom-up concerns about safety over any kind of goals, over any kind of needs, over any kind of forward movement in their life. They constantly feel threatened. They constantly feel on the verge of abandonment. And they constantly are swarmed by emotions associated with jealousy, envy, or anxiety. On the other hand, people who are left dominant very often will, for instance, seek jobs that have great titles and great benefits in companies where they have no friends, no connections, simply because the jobs look good and will accrue them tribal status. And they wind up increasingly alone and isolated, seeking monetary rewards, seeking status, but without any understanding of then why they feel hollow, empty, purposeless, meaningless in their life. So we see suffering coming from poor integration all the time. When in childhood, we learn to integrate left and right through all these wonderful games. There's this thing called crossing the line where children are instructed to close their eyes and use their right hand to touch their left ear and so forth. That's actually integrating different hemispheres of the brain, because especially your left hand is using your right subdominant hemisphere and your right's using your dominant. So you're beginning to cross the line. Then you also play clapping games in childhood. You'll notice that there's songs where they ask kids to clap. That's building bilateral integration, and they have balancing skills, and they teach kids to to express themselves in words and so forth. Bilateral integration is what allows us to laugh. Without it, we find no humor. Nothing is particularly funny, because things only attain humor when left top-down rules are broken by right bottom-up aggression. It's literally, if you want to read about it, check out Freud's Jokes in the Unconscious and other theories of how humor works. But when you see people laughing, that's when you see both frontal lobes most activated. In childhood, actually adults, well, I already covered that, so I'm going to just jump ahead. When we are hijacked by one side of the brain, we very often fixate on something we don't have. We fixate on people who might have everything in their life but a romantic partner, but they'll fixate at that at the expense of seeing everything else in their life. They'll ruminate, they'll lose connection with the world around them. And this is a state called craving, which the Buddha said is responsible for much of our suffering, and it's associated with left top-down attention. So, how do we develop on an ongoing basis a way to read all of the signals that our brain is sending us and integrate them together? Well, the process is actually much easier to than it might seem. It not only occurs when we're doing things that are creative, when you're listening to music or when you're singing a song, states of flow, when you're completely immersed in an activity that requires focused attention, that's left, but body awareness. So if you've ever ridden a bike, surfed, ridden a skateboard, if you've ever done yoga, if you've ever attended a novel stimuli in life where suddenly you see things that you've never seen before, like I suppose the Grand Canyon, and you stop in your tracks. Now, bottom-up circuits are forcing your left top-down to reintegrate a whole new picture of what reality can be like. If you travel to a distant location where people have completely different ways of living, it destroys all the left top-down models of the way life should be lived and forces you to develop what's called new predictive models that will guide your priorities and how you make sense of the world. That's why traveling is so vital. If we don't know how to read our body, we won't know when to rest. We won't know how and when we need to connect. We'll sometimes over-prioritize getting away and isolating over connection or connecting when we need to find security, safety, down-regulate, reduce the stimuli around us. We won't know when our body needs food. We won't know when our and we won't know when our body is or isn't ready for sex, too, when people can't read their body cues. So, mindfulness, embodied awareness, and putting the awareness of our bodies, the Buddha said, labeling what our bodies are telling us, which is known as Vedananusati and Cittanusati, which are the very heart of mindfulness practice, are the way we, on an ongoing basis, begin the, I say, the vital practice of learning how to understand ourselves, learning how to understand all of the needs and concerns that our brains and our mental function are conveying to us. When we read our body and we can turn it into a feeling of sadness, anger, joy, shock, loneliness, satiation, tranquility. Anytime you turn a feeling state into words, you have literally fully integrated and learned how to integrate both top-down and right-hand bottom-up processes. And then you can integrate those messages into decisions. If you know something like looks good, but you feel your stomach tightening, your throat getting taut in a knot, you feel you have every reason in your life to be happy, but still there's a nagging anxiety or a nagging sense of unsettledness. It means that there's a very important vital survival or safety or connection message being sent that we need to read and simply appreciate. And also, when we name internal states, we actually help regulate our emotions. There's an old saying, you name it to tame it. And that's because when you engage your left hemisphere to name and turn a body state into a message, your left establishes some dominance and helps relieve the pressure of anxiety or depression as it expresses itself. We make decisions confidently without stalling because we've integrated all of our concerns with our future goals, and they work together hand in hand. So anyway, tonight we're going to practice now mindfulness, and we're going to practice watching and learning, or watching and developing the skill of translating all of the feelings and affects arising and passing into messages that we can appreciate. So thanks for listening. I hope something was worthwhile. So find a really comfortable seated position. So just take a nice full breath in and out. Try to find some set of sensations in your internal experience, i.e., sensations that other people can't see, that feel really comfortable to rest attention on for a moment, just to find an anchor so that our attention, which has been largely exteroceptive, looking around the room, listening to words and ideas. And what we want to do is bring it back entirely to another state, internal awareness. So try to find the sensation of your breathing in and out in any area of your body that feels comfortable. Could be the tip of the nose, the shoulders, the throat, the chest, the belly. And the Buddha's first meditation instruction is simply to breathe in and out, knowing when you're breathing in, knowing when you're breathing out, and breathing in a way that just feels soothing to your body. So if you're really tired, you might want to emphasize the in-breath. You could even meditate with one eye open. You could count inhalations and exhalations from 1 to 5 and back down. If you're anxious, your mind won't settle and relax. Then you want to incline the out-breath to be slower, softer, not pushing out air, but just releasing it. Releasing the shoulders, softening the belly, allowing the belly to be so soft. The breath feels like it's expanding a balloon and releasing. Whenever our thoughts grab hold of our attention and we start following them away from our body, the present moment, there's nothing at all to be frustrated by. It doesn't mean anything's wrong. Simply a small part of the brain trying to grab hold of and dominate. Just gently bring your attention back to the body, to your body breathing. If you'd like, include all the sounds of the room. You can include an awareness, the closed eye visuals, the light patterns flickering. Or you can hold an image of a person or being you associate with compassion, or a place you've been to where you feel safe. And the practice is not to simply find immediate concentration. The practice is just to gently, again and again, note when our attention has wandered and bring it back. If you can do this, then all the times in your life when you are rattled with intrusive thoughts, repetitive fears and worries, you'll have developed the circuits allowing you to disattach or detach, I should say, from ideas, concerns, worries, and just return to your actual lived experience, where almost all the time, nothing scary is happening. Present time is a refuge. Every time your attention wanders and you bring it back, you can use it as an opportunity to create a greater state of ease. Dropping the shoulders, opening up the chest. If it doesn't feel inauthentic, try to just have a soft, kind of Mona Lisa-like half smile, signaling to nonverbal regions of the brain that everything's okay right now. You can place a hand on your heart center to activate the vagal nerve, informing that you're around people that want you to be happy and want to be truly happy as well. So for the next part, we're gonna just do a practice learning to appreciate and translate, or at least integrate the nonverbal messages that are being sent to us from regions of the brain that are so vital but so easily misunderstood. So just one, take a moment to survey your body. Hopefully right now you're somewhat relaxed. Note how your abdomen, belly feels. Note how you're breathing. Note if your attention is settled or jumpy. If your chest feels open and spacious or tight, even the subtlest sensations of tightness in the face muscles or ease, if the muscles around the eyes feel soft or not. And then bring to mind some person or choice or opportunity something that you may find yourself procrastinating over, stuck, unresolved. And as you hold an image of this, representing this choice, this possibility, this person, this unresolved issue, just hold something, an image that represents it, and then just see if you can bring your attention back to your body and notice even the slightest shifts . It might not be overt. It might just be the slightest change of tightness in the throat or in the belly. Maybe the eyebrows start to tighten. Maybe the breath becomes a little shallower or longer. And if you can read these expressions, what's called somatic markers or gut feelings, to see if you can come up with a word that describes what they're trying to tell you. And you'll know if that word is right because there'll be a feeling of settledness. And if the word is wrong, nothing will change. And if this very little change, you can try a different image, a different concern. And just stay aware for even the subtlest sign, sometimes a feeling of hollowness, numbness, suddenly muscles relaxing. Suddenly it's harder to stay present. Mindfulness of feelings and emotions are simply paying attention to our internal states and then learning to find a label, an interpretation to understand. So in a moment, I'm going to bring this practice to its conclusion. So just take your time, slowly reintegrating sight, sounds, external awareness. But try to bring with you the attention to your body that you cultivated. One of the goals of practice is maintaining a level of embodied awareness, not just when we're meditating, but as an ongoing practice so that we can begin to appreciate the whole picture, not just a fraction of it.